If black holes were as varied as the objects that collapse to form them, it might be very difficult to make any predictions about black holes in general. In 1967, however, the study of black holes was revolutionized by Werner Israel, a Canadian scientist. He was born in Berlin, brought up in South Africa, and took his doctoral degree in Ireland. Israel showed that according to general relativity, non-rotating black holes must be very simple. They were perfectly spherical, their size depended only on their mass, and any two such black holes with the same mass were identical. They could, in fact, be described by a particular solution of Einstein's equations that had been known since 1917, found by Karl Schwarzschild shortly after the discovery of general relativity. At first, many people, including Israel himself, argued that since black holes had to be perfectly spherical, a black hole could only form from the collapse of a perfectly spherical object. Any real star, which would never be perfectly spherical, could therefore only collapse to form a naked singularity. There was, however, a different interpretation of Israel's result, which was advocated by Roger Penrose and John Wheeler in particular. They argued that the rapid movements involved in a star's collapse would mean that the gravitational waves it gave off would make it ever more spherical, and by the time it had settled down to a stationary state, it would be precisely spherical. According to this view, any non-rotating star, however complicated its shape and internal structure, would end up, after gravitational collapse, as a perfectly spherical black hole, whose size would depend only on its mass. Further calculations supported the view, and it soon came to be adopted generally. Israel's result dealt with the case of black holes formed from non-rotating bodies only. In 1963, Roy Kerr, a New Zealander, found a set of solutions of the equations of general relativity that describe rotating black holes. These Kerr black holes rotate at a constant rate, their size and shape depending only on their mass and rate of rotation. If the rotation is zero, the black hole is perfectly round and the solution is identical to the Schwarzschild solution. If the rotation is non-zero, the black hole bulges outward near its equator, just as the Earth or the Sun bulge due to their rotation, and the faster it rotates, the more it bulges. So, to extend Israel's result to include rotating bodies, it was conjectured that any rotating body that collapsed to form a black hole would eventually settle down to a stationary state described by the Kerr solution. In 1970, a colleague and fellow research student of mine at Cambridge, Brandon Carter, took the first step toward proving this conjecture. He showed that, provided a stationary rotating black hole had an axis of symmetry like a spinning top, its size and shape would depend only on its mass and rate of rotation. Then in 1971, I proved that any stationary rotating black hole would indeed have such an axis of symmetry. Finally, in 1973, David Robinson at King's College London used Carter's and my results to show that the conjecture had been correct. Such a black hole had indeed to be the Kerr solution. So, after gravitational collapse, a black hole must settle down into a state in which it would be rotating but not pulsating. Moreover, its size and shape would depend only on its mass and rate of rotation, and not on the nature of the body that had collapsed to form it. This result became known by the maxim, a black hole has no hair. The no-hair theorem is of great practical importance because it so greatly restricts the possible types of black holes. One can, therefore, make detailed models of objects that might contain black holes and compare the predictions of the models with observations. It also means that a very large amount of information about the body that has collapsed must be lost when a black hole is formed, because afterward, all we can possibly measure about the body is its mass and rate of rotation. The significance of this will be seen in the next chapter. Black holes are one of only a fairly small number of cases in the history of science in which a theory was developed in great detail as a mathematical model before there was any evidence from observations that it was correct. Indeed, this used to be the main argument of opponents to black holes. How could one believe in objects for which the only evidence was calculations based on the dubious theory of general relativity? In 1963, however, Martin Schmidt, an astronomer at the Panama Observatory in California, measured the red shift of a faint star-like object in the direction of the source of radio waves called 3C273. That is source number 273 in the Third Cambridge Catalogue of Radio Sources. He found it was too large to be caused by a gravitational field. If it had been a gravitational redshift, the object would have to be so massive and so near to us that it would disturb the orbits of planets in the solar system. This suggested that the redshift was instead caused by the expansion of the universe, which in turn meant that the object was a very large distance away. And to be visible at such a great distance, the object must be very bright, must, in other words, be emitting a huge amount of energy. The only mechanism that people would think of that would produce such large quantities of energy seemed to be the gravitational collapse, not just of a star, but of a whole central region of a galaxy. A number of other similar quasi-stellar objects, or quasars, have been discovered, all with large red shifts. But they are all too far away and therefore too difficult to observe to provide conclusive evidence of black holes. Further encouragement for the existence of black holes came in 1967 with the discovery by a research student at Cambridge, Jocelyn Bell, of objects in the sky that were emitting regular pulses of radio waves. At first, Bell and her supervisor, Anthony Hewish, thought that they might have made contact with an alien civilization in the galaxy. Indeed, at the seminar at which they announced their discovery, I remember that they called the first four sources to be found LGM 1 to 4. LGM standing for Little Green Men. In the end, however, they and everyone else came to the less romantic conclusion that these objects, which were given the name pulsars, were in fact rotating neutron stars that were emitting pulses of radio waves because of a complicated interreaction between their magnetic fields and surrounding matter. This was bad news for writers of space westerns, but very hopeful for the number of us who believed in black holes at that time. It was the first positive evidence that neutron stars existed. A neutron star has a radius of about 10 miles, only a few times the critical radius at which a star becomes a black hole. If a star could collapse to such a small size, it is not unreasonable to expect that other stars could collapse to even smaller size and become black holes. How could we hope to detect a black hole, as by its very definition, it doesn't emit any light? It might seem a bit like looking for a black cat in a coal cellar. Fortunately, there is a way. As John Mitchell pointed out in his pioneering paper in 1783, a black hole still exerts a gravitational force on nearby objects. Astronomers have observed many systems in which two stars orbit around each other, attracted toward each other by gravity. They also observe systems in which there is only one visible star that is orbiting around some unseen companion. One cannot, of course, immediately conclude that the companion is a black hole. It might merely be a star that is too faint to be seen. However, some of these systems, like the one called Cygnus X1, are also strong sources of X-rays. The best explanation for this phenomenon is that matter has been blown off the surface of the visible star. As it falls toward the unseen companion, it develops a spiral motion, rather like water running out of a bathtub, and it gets very hot, emitting X-rays. For this mechanism to work, the unseen object has to be very small, like a white dwarf neutron star or black hole. From the observed orbit of the visible star, one can determine the lowest possible mass of the unseen object. In the case of Cygnus X1, this is about 6 times the mass of the Sun, which, according to Chandrasekhar's result, is too great for the unseen object to be a white dwarf. It is also too large a mass to be a neutron star. It seems, therefore, that it must be a black hole. There are other models to explain Cygnus X1 that do not include a black hole, but they're all rather far-fetched. A black hole seems to be the only really natural explanation of the observations. Despite this, I have a bet with Kip Thorne of the California Institute of Technology that, in fact, Cygnus X1 does not contain a black hole. This is a form of insurance policy for me. I've done a lot of work on black holes, and it would all be wasted if it turned out that black holes don't exist. But in that case, I would have the consolation of winning my bet, which would bring me 4 years of the magazine Private Eye. If black holes do exist, Kip will get 1 year of Penthouse. When we made the bet in 1975, we were 80% certain that Cygnus was a black hole. By now, I would say that we're about 95% certain, but the bet has yet to be settled. We also now have evidence for several other black holes in systems like Cygnus X-1 in our galaxy and in two neighboring galaxies called the Magellanic Clouds. The number of black holes, however, is almost certainly very much higher. In the long history of the universe, many stars must have burned all their nuclear fuel and had to collapse. The number of black holes may well be greater even than the number of visible stars, which totals about 100,000 million in our galaxy alone. The extra gravitational attraction of such a large number of black holes could explain why our galaxy rotates at the rate it does. The mass of the visible stars is insufficient to account for this. We also have some evidence that there's a much larger black hole with a mass of about 100,000 times that of the Sun at the center of our galaxy. Stars in the galaxy that come too near this black hole will be torn apart by the difference in the gravitational forces on their near and far sides. Their remains, and gas that is thrown off other stars, will fall toward the black hole. As in the case of Cygnus X-1, the gas will spiral inward and will heat up, though not as much as in that case. It will not get hot enough to emit X-rays, but it could account for the very compact source of radio waves and infrared rays that is observed at the galactic center. It is thought that similar but even larger black holes with masses of about 100 million times the mass of the Sun occur at the centers of quasars. Matter falling into such a supermassive black hole would provide the only source of power great enough to explain the enormous amounts of energy that these objects are emitting. As the matter spirals into the black hole, it would make the black hole rotate in the same direction, causing it to develop a magnetic field rather like that of the Earth. Very high energy particles would be generated near the black hole by the infalling matter. The magnetic field would be so strong that it could focus these particles into jets ejected outward along the axis of rotation of the black hole, that is, in the directions of its north and south poles. Such jets are indeed observed in a number of galaxies and quasars. One can also consider the possibility that there might be black holes with masses much less than that of the Sun. Such black holes could not be formed by gravitational collapse because their masses are below the Chandrishka mass limit. Stars of this low mass can support themselves against the force of gravity even when they've exhausted their nuclear fuel. Low-mass black holes could form only if matter was compressed to enormous densities by very large external pressures. Such conditions could occur in a very big hydrogen bomb. The physicist John Wheeler once calculated that if one took all the heavy water in all the oceans of the world, one could build a hydrogen bomb that would compress matter at the center so much that a black hole would be created. Of course, there would be no one left to observe it. A more practical possibility is that such low-mass black holes might have been formed in the high temperatures and pressures of the very early universe. Black holes would have been formed only if the early universe had not been perfectly smooth and uniform, because only a small region that was denser than average could be compressed in this way to form a black hole. But we know that there must have been some irregularities, because otherwise the matter in the universe would still be perfectly uniformly distributed at the present epoch instead of being clumped together in stars and galaxies. Whether the irregularities required to account for stars and galaxies would have led to the formation of a significant number of primordial black holes clearly depends on the details of the conditions in the early universe. So if we could determine how many primordial black holes there are now, we would learn a lot about the very early stages of the universe. Primordial black holes with masses more than 1,000 million tons, the mass of a large mountain, could be detected only by their gravitational influence on other visible matter or on the expansion of the universe. However, as we shall learn in the next chapter, black holes are not really black after all. They glow like a hot body, and the smaller they are, the more they glow. So, paradoxically, smaller black holes might actually turn out to be easier to detect than large ones. Chapter 7. Black Holes Ain't So Black. Before 1970, my research on general relativity had concentrated mainly on the question of whether or not there had been a Big Bang singularity. However, one evening in November that year, shortly after the birth of my daughter Lucy, I started to think about black holes as I was getting into bed. My disability makes this rather a slow process, so I have plenty of time. At that date, there was no precise definition of which points in space-time lay inside a black hole and which lay outside. I had already discussed with Roger Penrose the idea of defining a black hole as the set of events from which it was not possible to escape to a large distance, which is now the generally accepted definition. It means that the boundary of the black hole, the event horizon, is formed by the paths in space-time of rays of light that just fail to get away from the black hole, hovering forever just on the edge. It's a bit like running away from the police and just managing to keep one step ahead but not being able to get clear away. Suddenly I realized that the paths of these light rays could never approach one another. If they did, they must eventually run into one another. It would be like meeting someone else running away from the police in the opposite direction. You'd both be caught, or in this case, fall into a black hole. But if these light rays were swallowed up by the black hole, then they could not have been on the boundary of the black hole. So the paths of light rays in the event horizon had always to be moving parallel to or away from each other. Another way of seeing this is that the event horizon, the boundary of the black hole, is like the edge of a shadow, the shadow of impending doom. If you look at the shadow cast by a source of at a great distance, such as the sun, you'll see that the rays of light in the edge are not approaching each other. If the rays of light that form the event horizon, the boundary of the black hole, can never approach each other, the area of the event horizon might stay the same or increase with time, but it could never decrease, because that would mean that at least some of the rays of light in the boundary would have to be approaching each other. In fact, the area would increase whenever matter of radiation fell into the black hole. Or if two black holes collided and merged together to form a single black hole, the area of the event horizon of the final black hole would be greater than or equal to the sum of the areas of the event horizons of the original black holes. This non-decreasing property of the event horizon's area placed an important restriction on the possible behavior of black holes. I was so excited with my discovery that I didn't get much sleep that night. The next day I rang up Roger Penrose. He agreed with me. I think, in fact, that he had been aware of this property of the area. However, he'd been using a slightly different definition of a black hole. He had not realized that the boundaries of the black hole, according to the two definitions, would be the same, and hence so would their areas, provided the black hole had settled down to a state in which it was not changing with time. The non-decreasing behavior of a black hole's area was very reminiscent of the behavior of a physical quantity called entropy, which measures the degree of disorder of a system. It is a matter of common experience that disorder will tend to increase if things are left to themselves. One has only to stop making repairs around the house to see that. One can create order out of disorder. For example, one can paint the house. But that requires expenditure of effort and energy, and so decreases the amount of ordered energy available. A precise statement of this idea is known as the second law of thermodynamics. It states that the entropy of an isolated system always increases, and that when two systems are joined together, the entropy of the combined system is greater than the sum of the entropies of the individual systems. For example, consider a system of gas molecules in a box. The molecules can be thought of as little billiard balls continually colliding with each other and bouncing off the walls of the box. The higher the temperature of the gas, the faster the molecules move, and so the more frequently and harder they collide with the walls of the box, and the greater the outward pressure that they exert on the walls. Suppose that initially the molecules are all confined to the left-hand side of a box by a partition. If the partition is then removed, the molecules will tend to spread out and occupy both halves of the box. At some later time, they could, by chance, all be in the right half or back in the left half, but it's overwhelmingly more probable that there will be roughly equal numbers in the two halves. Such a state is less ordered or more disordered than the original state in which all the molecules were in one half. One therefore says that the entropy of the gas has gone up. Similarly, suppose one starts with two boxes, one containing oxygen molecules and the other containing nitrogen molecules. If one joins the boxes together and removes the intervening wall, the oxygen and the nitrogen molecules will start to mix. At a later time, the most probable state will be a fairly uniform mixture of oxygen and nitrogen molecules throughout the two boxes. This state will be less ordered and hence have more entropy than the initial state of the two separate boxes. The second law of thermodynamics has a rather different status than that of other laws of science, such as Newton's law of gravity, for example, because it does not hold always just in the vast majority of cases. The probability of all the gas molecules in our first box being found in one half of the box at a later time is many millions of millions to one, but it can happen. However, if one has a black hole around, there seems to be a rather easier way of violating the second law. Just throw some matter with a lot of entropy, such as a box of gas, down the black hole. The total entropy of matter outside the black hole would go down. One could, of course, still say that the total entropy, including the entropy inside the black hole, has not gone down, but since there is no way to look inside the black hole, we cannot see how much entropy the matter inside it has. It would be nice, then, if there was some feature of the black hole by which observers outside the black hole could tell its entropy, and which would increase whenever matter carrying entropy fell into the black hole. Following the discovery, described above, that the area of the event horizon increased whenever matter fell into a black hole, a research student at Princeton named Jacob Birkenstein suggested that the area of the event horizon was a measure of the entropy of the black hole. The matter carrying entropy fell into a black hole, the area of its event horizon would go up, so that the sum of the entropy of matter outside black holes and the area of the horizons would never go down. This suggestion seemed to prevent the second law of thermodynamics from being violated in most situations. However, there was one fatal flaw. If a black hole has entropy, then it ought also to have a temperature. But a body with a particular temperature must emit radiation at a certain time. It's a matter of common experience that if one heats up a poker in a fire, it glows red hot and emits radiation. But bodies at lower temperatures emit radiation too. One just does not normally notice it because the amount is fairly small. This radiation is required in order to prevent violation of the second law. So black holes ought to emit radiation. But by their very definition, black holes are objects that are not supposed to emit anything. It therefore seemed that the area of the event horizon of a black hole could not be regarded as its entropy. In 1972, I wrote a paper with Brandon Carter and an American colleague, Jim Barton, in which we pointed out that although there were many similarities between entropy and the area of the event horizon, there was this apparently fatal difficulty. I must admit that in writing this paper, I was motivated partly by irritation with Bekenstein, who I felt had misused my discovery of the increase of the area of the event horizon. However, it turned out in the end that he was basically correct, though in a manner he had certainly not expected. In September 1973, while I was visiting Moscow, I discussed black holes with two leading Soviet experts, Yakov Veldovich and Alexander Starobinsky. They convinced me that according to the quantum mechanical uncertainty principle, rotating black holes should create and emit particles. I believe their arguments on physical grounds, but I did not like the mathematical way in which they calculated the emission. I therefore set about devising a better mathematical treatment, which I described at an informal seminar in Oxford at the end of November 73. At that time, I had not done the calculations to find out how much would actually be emitted. I was expecting to discover just the radiation that Zeldovich and Starobinsky had predicted from rotating black holes. However, when I did the calculation, I found to my surprise and annoyance that even non-rotating black holes should apparently create and emit particles at a steady rate. At first, I thought that this emission indicated that one of the approximations I had used was not valid. I was afraid that if Bekenstein found out about it, he would use it as a further argument to support his ideas about the entropy of black holes, which I still did not like. However, the more I thought about it, the more it seemed that the approximations really ought to hold. But what finally convinced me that the emission was real was that the spectrum of the emitted particles was exactly that which will be emitted by a hot body, and that the black hole was emitting particles at exactly the correct rate to prevent violations of the second law. Since then, the calculations have been repeated in a number of different forms by other people. They all confirm that a black hole ought to emit particles and radiation as if it were a hot body with a temperature that depends only on the black hole's mass. The higher the mass, the lower the temperature. How is it possible that a black hole appears to emit particles when we know that nothing can escape from within its event horizon? The answer, quantum theory tells us, is that the particles do not come from within the black hole, but from the empty space just outside the black hole's event horizon. We can understand this in the following way. What we think of as empty space cannot be completely empty, because that would mean that all the fields, such as the gravitational and electromagnetic fields, would have to be exactly zero. However, the value of a field and its rate of change with time are like the position and velocity of a particle. The uncertainty principle implies that the more accurately one knows one of these quantities, the less accurately one can know the other. So in empty space, the field cannot be fixed at exactly zero, because then it would have both a precise value, zero, and a precise rate of change, also zero. There must be a certain minimum amount of uncertainty or quantum fluctuations in the value of the field. One can think of these fluctuations as pairs of particles of light or gravity that appear together at some time, move apart, and then come together again and annihilate each other. These particles are virtual particles like the particles that carry the gravitational force of the sun. Unlike real particles, they can't be observed directly with a particle detector. However, their indirect effects, such as small changes in the energy of electron orbits in atoms, can be measured and agree with the theoretical predictions to a remarkable degree of accuracy. The uncertainty principle also predicts that there will be similar virtual pairs of matter particles, such as electrons or quarks. In this case, however, one member of the pair will be a particle and the other an antiparticle. The antiparticles of light and gravity are the same as the particles. Because energy cannot be created out of nothing, one of the partners in a particle-antiparticle pair will have positive energy and the other partner negative energy. The one with negative energy is condemned to be a short-lived virtual particle, because real particles always have positive energy in normal situations. It must, therefore, seek out its partner and annihilate with it. However, a real particle close to a massive body has less energy than if it were far away, because it would take the energy to lift it far away against the gravitational attraction of the body. Normally, the energy of the particle is still positive, but the gravitational field inside a black hole is so strong that even a real particle can have negative energy there. It is therefore possible, if a black hole is present, for the virtual particle with negative energy to fall into the black hole and become a real particle or antiparticle. In this case, it no longer has to annihilate with its partner. Its forsaken partner may fall into the black hole as well, or having positive energy, it might also escape from the vicinity of the black hole as a real particle or antiparticle. To an observer at a distance, it will appear to have been emitted from the black hole. The smaller the black hole, the shorter the distance the particle with negative energy will have to go before it becomes a real particle, and thus the greater the rate of emission and the apparent temperature of the black hole. The positive energy of the outgoing radiation will be balanced by a flow of negative energy particles into the black hole. By Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, where E is energy, m is mass, and c is the speed of light, energy is proportional to mass. A flow of negative energy into the black hole therefore reduces its mass. As the black hole loses mass, the area of its event horizon gets smaller, but this decrease in the entropy of the black hole is more than compensated for by the entropy of the emitted radiation, so the second law is never violated. Moreover, the lower the mass of the black hole, the higher its temperature. So as the black hole loses mass, its temperature and rate of emission increase, so it loses mass more quickly. What happens when the mass of the black hole eventually becomes extremely small is not quite clear, but the most reasonable guess is that it would disappear completely in a tremendous final burst of emission, equivalent to the explosion of millions of H-bombs. A black hole with a mass a few times that of the sun would have a temperature of only 1/10 millionth of a degree above absolute zero. This is much less than the temperature of the microwave radiation that fills the universe, about 2.7 above absolute zero, so such black holes would emit even less than they absorb. If the universe is destined to go on expanding forever, the temperature of the microwave radiation will eventually decrease to less than that of such a black hole, which will then begin to lose mass. But even then, its temperature would be so low that it would take about a million, 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 million years, one with 66 zeros after it, to evaporate completely. This is much longer than the age of the universe, which is only about 10 or 20,000 million years, one or two with 10 zeros after it. On the other hand, as mentioned in Chapter 6, there might be primordial black holes with a very much smaller mass that were made by the collapse of irregularities in the very early stages of the universe. Such black holes would have a much higher temperature and would be emitting radiation at a much higher rate. A primordial black hole with an initial mass of 1,000 million tons would have a lifetime roughly equal to the age of the universe. Primordial black holes with initial masses less than this figure would already have completely evaporated, but those with slightly greater masses would still be emitting radiation in the form of X-rays and gamma rays. These X-rays and gamma rays are like waves of light, but with a much shorter wavelength. Such holes hardly deserve the epithet black. They really are white hot and are emitting energy at a rate of about 10,000 megawatts. One such black hole could run 10 large power stations if only we could harness the power. This will be rather difficult, however. The black hole would have the mass of a mountain compressed into less than a million millionth of an inch, the size of the nucleus of an atom. If you have one of these black holes on the surface of the Earth, there would be no way to stop it from falling through the floor to the center of the Earth. It would oscillate through the Earth and back until eventually it settled down at the center. So the only place to put such a black hole in which one might use the energy that it emitted would be in orbit around the Earth. And the only way that one could get it to orbit the Earth would be to attract it there by towing a large mass in front of it, rather like a carrot in front of a donkey. This doesn't sound like a very practical proposition, at least not in the immediate future. But even if we cannot harness the emission from these primordial black holes, what are our chances of observing them? We could look for the gamma rays that the primordial black holes emit during most of their lifetime. Although the radiation from most would be very weak because they are far away, the total from all of them might be detectable. However, this background could have been and probably was generated by processes other than primordial black holes. One can therefore say that the observations of the gamma ray background do not provide any positive evidence for primordial black holes, but they do tell us that on average there cannot be more than 300 in every cubic light year in the universe. This limit means that primordial black holes could make up most 1/1,000,000th of the matter in the universe. With primordial black holes being so scarce, it might seem unlikely that there would be one near enough for us to observe as an individual source of gamma rays, but since gravity would draw primordial black holes toward any matter, they should be much more common in and around galaxies. So although the gamma ray background tells us that there can be no more than 300 primordial black holes per cubic light year on average, it tells us nothing about how common they might be in our galaxy. If they were, say, a million times more common than this, then the nearest black hole to us would probably be at a distance of about 1,000 million kilometers, or about as far away as Pluto, the farthest known planet. At this distance, it would still be very difficult to detect the steady emission of a black hole, even if it was 10,000 megawatts. In order to observe a primordial black hole, one would have to detect several gamma ray quanta coming from the same direction within a reasonable space of time, such as a week. Otherwise, they might simply be part of the background. But Planck's quantum principle tells us that each gamma ray quantum has a very high energy because gamma rays have a very high frequency. So it would not take many quanta to radiate even 10,000 megawatts. And to observe these few coming from the distance of Pluto would require a larger gamma ray detector than any that have been constructed thus far. Moreover, the detector would have to be in space because gamma rays cannot penetrate the atmosphere. Of course, if a black hole as close as Pluto were to reach the end of its life and blow up, it would be easy to detect the final burst of emission. But if a black hole has been emitting for the last 10 or 20,000 million years, the chance of it reaching the end of its life within the next few years, rather than several million years in the past or future, well, it's really rather small. So in order to have a reasonable chance of seeing an explosion before your research grant ran out, you'd have to find a way to detect any explosions within a distance of about one light year. You'd still have the problem of needing a large gamma ray detector to observe several gamma ray quanta from the explosion. However, in this case, it would not be necessary to determine that all the quanta came from the same direction. It would be enough to observe that they all arrive within a very short time interval to be reasonably confident that they were coming from the same burst. One gamma ray detector that might be capable of spotting primordial black holes is the entire Earth's atmosphere. We are in any case unlikely to be able to build a larger detector. When a high-energy gamma-ray quantum hits the atoms in our atmosphere, it creates pairs of electrons and positrons, anti-electrons. When these hit other atoms, they in turn create more pairs of electrons and positrons, so one gets what is called an electron shower. The result is a form of light called Cherenkov radiation. One can therefore detect gamma-ray bursts by looking for flashes of light in the night sky. Of course, there are a number of other phenomena, such as lightning and reflections of sunlight off tumbling satellites and orbiting debris, that can also give flashes in the sky. One could distinguish gamma-ray bursts from such effects by observing flashes simultaneously at two or more fairly widely separated locations. A search like this has been carried out by two scientists from Dublin, Neil Porter and Trevor Weeks, using telescopes in Arizona. They found a number of flashes, but none that could be definitely ascribed to gamma-ray bursts from primordial black holes. Even if the search for primordial black holes proves negative, as it seems it may, it will still give us important information about the very early stages of the universe. If the early universe had been chaotic or irregular, or if the pressure of matter had been low, one would have expected it to produce many more primordial black holes than the limit already set by our observations of the gamma-ray background. Only, if the early universe was very smooth and uniform with a high pressure, can one explain the absence of observable numbers of primordial black holes. The idea of radiation from black holes was the first example of a prediction that depended in an essential way on both the great theories of the century, general relativity and quantum mechanics. It aroused a lot of opposition initially because it upset the existing viewpoint. How can a black hole emit anything? When I first announced the results of my calculations at a conference at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory near Oxford, I was greeted with general incredulity. At the end of my talk, the chairman of the session, John G. Taylor from King's College London, claimed it was all nonsense. He even wrote a paper to that effect. However, in the end, most people, including John Taylor, have come to the conclusion that black holes must radiate like hot bodies if our other ideas about general relativity and quantum mechanics are correct. Thus, even though we have not yet managed to find a primordial black hole, there is fairly general agreement that if we did, it would have to be emitting a lot of gamma rays and X-rays. The existence of radiation from black holes seems to imply that gravitational collapse is not as final and irreversible as we once thought. If an astronaut falls into a black hole, its mass will increase, but eventually the energy equivalent of that extra mass will be returned to the universe in the form of radiation. Thus, in a sense, the astronaut will be recycled. It will be a poor sort of immortality, however, because any person or personal concept of time for the astronaut would almost certainly come to an end as he was torn apart inside the black hole. Even the types of particles that were eventually emitted by the black hole would in general be different from those that made up the astronaut. The only feature of the astronaut that would survive would be his mass or energy. The approximations I use to derive the emissions from black holes should work well when the black hole has a mass greater than a fraction of a gram. However, they will break down at the end of a black hole's life when its mass gets very small. The most likely outcome seems to be that the black hole will just disappear, at least from our region of the universe, taking with it the astronaut and any singularity there might be inside it, if indeed there is one. This was the first indication that quantum mechanics might remove the singularities that were predicted by general relativity. However, the methods that I and other people were using in 74 were not able to answer questions such as whether singularities would occur in quantum gravity. From 1975 onward, I therefore started to develop a more powerful approach to quantum gravity based on Richard Feynman's idea of a sum of over histories. The answers that this approach suggests for the origin and fate of the universe and its contents, such as astronauts, will be described in the next two chapters. We shall see that although the uncertainty principle places limitations on the accuracy of all our predictions, it may at the same time remove the fundamental unpredictability that occurs at a space-time singularity. Chapter 8, The Origin and Fate of the Universe. Einstein's general theory of relativity, on its own, predicted that space-time began at the Big Bang singularity and would come to an end either at the Big Crunch singularity, if the whole universe recollapsed, or at a singularity inside a black hole, if a local region such as a star were to collapse. Any matter that fell into the hole would be destroyed at the singularity, and only the gravitational effect of its mass would continue to be felt outside. On the other hand, when quantum effects were taken into account, it seemed that the mass or energy of the matter would eventually be returned to the rest of the universe, and that the black hole, along with any singularity inside it, would evaporate away and finally disappear. Could quantum mechanics have an equally dramatic effect on the Big Bang and the Big Crunch singularities? What really happens during the very early or late stages of the universe when gravitational fields are so strong that quantum effects cannot be ignored? Does the universe, in fact, have a beginning or an end? And if so, what are they like? Throughout the 1970s, I'd been mainly studying black holes, but in 1981, my interest in questions about the origin and the fate of the universe was reawakened when I attended a conference on cosmology organized by the Jesuits in the Vatican. The Catholic Church had made a bad mistake with Galileo when it tried to lay down the law on a question of science declaring that the sun went around the earth. Now, centuries later, it had decided to invite a number of experts to advise it on cosmology. At the end of the conference, the participants were granted an audience with the Pope. He told us that it was all right to study the evolution of the universe after the Big Bang, but we should not inquire into the Big Bang itself, because that was the moment of creation, and therefore the work of God. I was glad, then, that he did not know the subject of the talk that I had just given at the conference, the possibility that space-time was finite, but had no boundary, which means that it had no beginning, no moment of creation. I had no desire to share the fate of Galileo, with whom I feel a strong sense of identity, partly because of the coincidence of having been born exactly 300 years after his death. In order to explain the ideas that I and other people have had about how quantum mechanics may affect the origin and fate of the universe, it is necessary first to understand the generally accepted history of the universe according to what is known as the hot Big Bang model. This assumes that the universe is described by a Friedman model, right back to the Big Bang. In such models, one finds that as the universe expands, any matter or radiation in it gets cooler. When the universe doubles in size, its temperature falls by half. Since temperature is simply a measure of the average energy or speed of the particles, this cooling of the universe would have a major effect on the matter in it. At very high temperatures, particles would be moving around so fast that they could escape any attraction toward each other due to nuclear or electromagnetic forces. But as they cooled off, one would expect particles that attract each other to start to clump together. Moreover, even the types of particles that exist in the universe would depend on the temperature. At high enough temperatures, particles have so much energy that whenever they collide, many different particle-antiparticle pairs would be produced. And though some of these particles would annihilate on hitting antiparticles, they would be produced more rapidly than they could annihilate. At lower temperatures, when colliding particles have less energy, particle-antiparticle pairs would be produced less quickly. and annihilation would become faster than production. At the Big Bang itself, the universe is thought to have had zero size, and so to have been infinitely hot. But as the universe expanded, the temperature of the radiation decreased. 1 second after the Big Bang, it would have fallen to about 10,000 million degrees. This is about 1,000 times the temperature at the center of the sun. But temperatures as high as this are reached in H-bomb explosions. At this time, the universe would have contained mostly photons, electrons, and neutrinos, extremely light particles that are affected only by the weak force and gravity, and their antiparticles, together with some protons and neutrons. As the universe continued to expand and the temperatures to drop, the rate at which electron-anti-electron pairs were being produced in collisions would have fallen below the rate at which they were being destroyed by annihilation. So most of the electrons and anti-electrons would have annihilated with each other to produce more photons, leaving only a few electrons left over. The neutrinos and antineutrinos, however, would not have annihilated with each other because these particles interact with themselves and with other particles only very weakly. So they should still be around today. If we could observe them, it would provide a good test of this picture of a very hot early stage of the universe. Unfortunately, their energies nowadays would be too low for us to observe them directly. However, if neutrinos are not massless, but have a small mass of their own, as suggested by an unconfirmed Russian experiment performed in 1981, we might be able to detect them indirectly. They could be a form of dark matter, like that mentioned earlier, with sufficient gravitational attraction to stop the expansion of the universe and cause it to collapse again. About 100 seconds after the Big Bang, the temperature would have fallen to 1,000 million degrees, the temperature inside the hottest stars. At this temperature, protons and neutrons would no longer have sufficient energy to escape the attraction of the strong nuclear force, and would have started to combine together to produce the nuclei of atoms and deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen, which contains one proton and one neutron. The deuterium nuclei would then have combined with more protons and neutrons to make helium nuclei, which contain two protons and two neutrons, and also small amounts of a couple of heavier elements, lithium and beryllium. One can calculate that in the hot Big Bang model, about a quarter of the protons and neutrons would have been converted into helium nuclei, along with a small amount of heavy hydrogen and other elements. The remaining neutrons would have decayed into protons, which are the nuclei of ordinary hydrogen atoms. This picture of a hot, early stage of the universe was first put forward by the scientist George Gamow in a famous paper written in 1948 with a student of his, Ralph Alpha. Gamow, who had quite a sense of humor, he persuaded the nuclear scientist Hans Bethe to add his name to the paper to make it the list of authors Alpha Beta Gamma, like the first three letters of the Greek alphabet, Alpha Beta Gamma, particularly appropriate for a paper on the beginning of the universe. In this paper, they made the remarkable prediction that radiation, in the form of photons, from the very hot early stages of the universe, should still be around today, but with its temperature reduced to only a few degrees above absolute zero, which is minus 273 degrees centigrade. It was this radiation that Penzias and Wilson found in 1965, at the time that Alpha, Beta, and Gamow wrote their paper. Not much was known about the nuclear reactions of protons and neutrons. Predictions made for the proportions of various elements in the early universe were therefore rather inaccurate. But these calculations have been repeated in the light of better knowledge and now agree very well with what we observe. It is, moreover, very difficult to explain in any other way why there should be so much helium in the universe. We are, therefore, fairly confident that we have the right picture, at least back to about 1 second after the Big Bang. Within only a few hours of the Big Bang, the production of helium and other elements would have stopped. And after that, for the next million years or so, the universe would have just continued expanding without anything much happening. Eventually, once the temperature had dropped to a few thousand degrees and electrons and nuclei no longer had enough energy to overcome the electromagnetic attraction between them, they would have started combining to form atoms. the universe as a whole would have continued expanding and cooling, but in regions that were slightly denser than average, the expansion would have been slowed down by the extra-gravitational attraction. This would eventually stop expansion in some regions and cause them to start to collapse, to re-collapse. As they were collapsing, the gravitational pull of matter outside these regions might start them rotating slightly. As the collapsing region got smaller, it would spin faster, just as skaters spinning on ice spin faster as they draw in their arms. Eventually, when the region got small enough, it would be spinning fast enough to balance the attraction of gravity, and in this way, disk-like rotating galaxies were born. Other regions, which did not happen to pick up a rotation, would become oval-shaped objects called elliptical galaxies. In these, the region would stop collapsing because individual parts of the galaxy would be orbiting stably around its center, but the galaxy would have no overall rotation. As time went on, the hydrogen and helium gas in the galaxies would break up into smaller clouds and would collapse under their own gravity. As these contracted, and the atoms within them collided with one another, the temperature of the gas would increase, until eventually it became hot enough to start nuclear fusion reactions. These would convert the hydrogen into more helium, and the heat given off would raise the pressure and so stop the clouds from contracting any further. They would remain stable in this state for a long time, as stars like our sun, burning hydrogen into helium and radiating the resulting energy as heat and light. More massive stars would need to be hotter to balance their stronger gravitational attraction, making the nuclear fusion reactions proceed so much more rapidly that they would use up their hydrogen in as little as 100 million years. They would then contract slightly, and as they heated up further, would start to convert helium into heavier elements like carbon or oxygen. This, however, would not release much more energy, so a crisis would occur, as was described in the chapter on black holes. What happens next is not completely clear, but it seems likely that the central regions of the star would collapse to a very dense state, such as a neutron star or black hole. The outer regions of the star may sometimes get blown off in a tremendous explosion called a supernova, which would outshine all the other stars in the galaxy. Some of the heavier elements produced near the end of the star's life would be flung back into the gas in the galaxy, and would provide some of the raw material for the next generation of stars. Our own sun contains about 2% of these heavier elements because it is a second or third generation star formed some 5,000 million years ago out of a cloud of rotating gas containing the debris of earlier supernovas. Most of the gas in that cloud went to form the sun or got blown away, but a small amount of the heavier elements collected together to form the bodies that now orbit the sun as planets, like the Earth. The Earth was initially very hot and without an atmosphere. In the course of time, it cooled and acquired an atmosphere from the emission of gases from the rocks. This early atmosphere was not one in which we could have survived. It contained no oxygen, but a lot of other gases that are poisonous to us, such as hydrogen sulfide, the gas that gives rotten eggs that smell. There are, however, other primitive forms of life that can flourish under such conditions. It's thought that they developed in the oceans, possibly as a result of chance combinations of atoms into large structures called macromolecules, which were capable of assembling other atoms in the ocean into similar structures. They would thus have reproduced themselves and multiplied. In some cases, there would be errors in the reproduction. Mostly, these errors would have been such that the new macromolecule could not reproduce itself and eventually would have been destroyed. However, a few of the errors would have produced new macromolecules that were even better at reproducing themselves. They would have therefore had an advantage and would have tended to replace the original macromolecules. In this way, a process of evolution was started that led to the development of more and more complicated self-reproducing organisms. The first primitive forms of life consumed various materials, including hydrogen sulfide, and released oxygen. This gradually changed the atmosphere to the composition that it has today and allowed the development of higher forms of life, such as fish, reptiles, mammals, and ultimately the human race. This picture of a universe that started off very hot and cooled as it expanded, is in agreement with all the observational evidence that we have today. Nevertheless, it leaves a number of important questions unanswered. Number one, why was the early universe so hot? Two, why is the universe so uniform on a large scale? Why does it look the same at all points of space and in all directions? In particular, why is the temperature of the microwave background radiation so nearly the same when we look in different directions? It's a bit like asking a number of students an exam question. If they all gave exactly the same answer, you can be pretty sure that they have communicated with each other. Yet, in the model described above, there would not have been time since the Big Bang for light to get from one distant region to another, even though the regions were close together in the early universe. According to the theory of relativity, if light cannot get from one region to another, no other information can. So there would be no way in which different regions in the early universe could have come to have had the same temperature as each other, unless, for some unexplained reason, they happened to start out with the same temperature. 3. Why did the universe start out with so nearly the critical rate of expansion that separates models that recollapse from those that go on expanding forever, so that even now, 10,000 million years later, it is still expanding at nearly the critical rate? If the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller by even one part in 100,000 million, the universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its present size. And 4. Despite the fact that the universe is so uniform and homogeneous on a large scale, it contains local irregularities such as stars and galaxies. These are thought to have developed from small differences in the density of the early universe from one region to another. What was the origin of these density fluctuations? The general theory of relativity, on its own, cannot explain these features or answer these questions because of its prediction that the universe started off with infinite density at the Big Bang singularity. At the singularity, general relativity and all other physical laws would break down. One couldn't predict what will come out of that singularity. As explained before, this means that one might as well cut the Big Bang and any events before it out of the theory because they can have no effect on what we observe. Space-time would have a boundary, a beginning, at the Big Bang. Science seems to have uncovered a set of laws that, within the limits set by the uncertainty principle, tell us how the universe will develop with time if we know its state at any one time. These laws may have originally been decreed by God, but it appears that he has since left the universe to evolve according to them and does not now intervene in it. But how did he choose the initial state or configuration of the universe? What were the boundary conditions at the beginning of time? One possible answer is to say that God chose the initial configuration of the universe for reasons that we cannot hope to understand. This would certainly have been within the power of an omnipotent being, but if he had started it off in such an incomprehensible way, why did he choose to let it evolve according to laws that we could understand? The whole history of science has been the gradual realization that events do not happen in an arbitrary manner, but that they reflect a certain underlying order, which may or may not be divinely inspired. It would be only natural to suppose that this order should apply not only to the laws, but also to the conditions at the boundary of space-time that specify the initial state of the universe. There may be a large number of models of the universe with different initial conditions that all obey the laws. There ought to be some principle that picks out one initial state, and hence one model, to represent our universe. One such possibility is what we call chaotic boundary conditions. These implicitly assume either that the universe is spatially infinite or that there are infinitely many universes. Under chaotic boundary conditions, the probability of finding any particular region of space in any given configuration just after the Big Bang is the same, in some sense, as the probability of finding it in any other configuration. The initial state of the universe is chosen purely randomly. This would mean that the early universe would have probably been very chaotic and irregular because there are many more chaotic and disordered configurations for the universe than there are smooth and ordered ones. If each configuration is equally probable, it is likely that the universe started out in a chaotic and disordered state, simply because there are so many more of them. It's difficult to see how such chaotic initial conditions could have given rise to a universe that is so smooth and regular on a large scale as ours is today.